out of the belly of hell, when the whale grounded upon the ocean's utmost bones, even then God heard the engulfed, repenting prophet when he cried. Then God spake unto the fish, and from the shuddering cold and blackness of the sea, the whale came breaching up towards the warm and pleasant sun and all the delights of air and earth, and vomited out Jonah upon the dry land. When the word of the Lord came a second time, and Jonah, bruised and beaten, his ears like two seashells, still multitudinously murmuring of the ocean, Jonah did the Almighty's bidding. And what was that, shipmates? To preach the truth to the face of falsehood, that was it. This, shipmates, this is that other lesson, and woe to that pilot of the living God who slights it. Woe to him whom this world charms from gospel duty. Woe to him who seeks to pour oil upon the waters when God has brewed him into a gale. Woe to him who seeks to please rather than to appall. Woe to him whose good name is more to him than goodness. Woe to him who in this world courts not dishonor. Woe to him who would not be true, even though to be false were salvation. Yea, woe to him who, as the great pilot Paul has it, while preaching to others, is himself a castaway. He drooped and fell away from himself for a moment. Then lifting his face to them again, showed a deep joy in his eyes, as he cried out with a heavenly enthusiasm, "But, oh, shipmates, on the starboard hand of every woe, there is sure delight, and higher the top of that delight than the bottom of the woe is deep. Is not the main truck higher than the kelson is low? Delight is to him a far, far upward and inward delight, who against the proud gods and commodores of this earth ever stands forth his own inexorable self. Delight is to him whose strong arms yet support him when the ship of this base, treacherous world has gone down beneath him. Delight is to him who gives no quarter in the truth, and kills, burns, and destroys all sin, though he pluck it out from under the robes of senators and judges. Delight, top gallant delight, is to him who acknowledges no law or lord, but the Lord his God, and is only a patriot to heaven. Delight is to him whom all the waves of the billows of the seas, of the boisterous mob, can never shake from this sure keel of the ages. And eternal delight and deliciousness will be his, who, coming to lay him down, can say with his final breath, O Father, chiefly known to me by thy rod, mortal or immortal, here I die. I have striven to be thine more than to be this world's or mine own. Yet this is nothing. I leave eternity to thee. For what is man that he should live out the lifetime of his God?
Side 2. Returning to the Spouter Inn some time later, I found Queequeg there quite alone. He was sitting on a bench before the fire, with his feet on the stove hearth. With much interest, I sat watching him. Savage though he was, and hideously marred about the face, at least to my taste, his countenance yet had something in it which was by no means disagreeable. You cannot hide the soul. Through all his unearthly tattooings, I thought I saw the traces of a simple, honest heart. And in his large, deep eyes, fiery black and bold, there seemed tokens of a spirit that would dare a thousand devils. After supper, and social chat and a smoke, we went to our room together. He made me a present of his embalmed head, took out his enormous tobacco wallet, and groping under the tobacco, drew out some $30 in silver. Then spreading them on the table and mechanically dividing them into two equal portions, pushed one of them towards me and said it was mine. I was going to remonstrate, but he silenced me by pouring them into my trousers pockets. I let them stay. That done, we went to bed, at peace with our own consciences and all the world. But we did not go to sleep without some little more chat. How it is, I know not, but there is no place like a bed for confidential disclosures between friends. Man and wife, they say, there open the very bottom of their souls to each other, and some old couples often lie and chat over old times till nearly morning. Thus, then, in our heart's honeymoon, lay I and Queequeg, a cozy, loving pair. And presently, Queequeg spoke of his native island. And eager to hear his history, I begged him to go on and tell it. He gladly complied. Though at the time I but ill comprehended not a few of his words, yet subsequent disclosures, when I had become more familiar with his broken phraseology, now enable me to present the whole story, such as it may prove, in the mere skeleton I give. Queequeg was a native of Kokovoko, an island far away to the west and south. It is not down in any map. True places never are. When a new-hatched savage running wild about his native woodlands in a grass clout, followed by the nibbling goats as if he were a green sapling, even then, in Queequeg's ambitious soul, there lurked a strong desire to see something more of Christendom than a specimen whaler or two. His father was a high chief, a king, his uncle a high priest, and on the maternal side, he boasted aunts who were the wives of unconquerable warriors. There was excellent blood in his veins, royal stuff, though sadly vitiated, I fear, by the cannibal propensity he nourished in his untutored youth. A Sag Harbor ship visited his father's bay, and Queequeg sought a passage to Christian lands. They put him down among the sailors, and made a whaleman of him. But like Tsar Peter, content to toil in the shipyards of foreign cities, Queequeg disdained no seeming ignominy, if thereby he might haply gain the power of enlightening his untutored countrymen. For at bottom, so he told me, he was actuated by a profound desire to learn among the Christians, the arts whereby to make his people still happier than they were, and more than that, still better than they were. But alas, the practices of whalemen soon convinced him that even Christians could be both miserable and wicked, infinitely more so than all his father's heathens. Arrived at last in old Sag Harbor, and seeing what the sailors did there, and then going on to Nantucket, and seeing how they spent their wages in that place also, poor Queequeg gave it up for lost. Thought he, it's a wicked world in all meridians. I'll die a pagan. And thus, an old idolater at heart, he yet lived among these Christians, wore their clothes, and tried to talk their gibberish. Hence the queer ways about him, though now some time from home. I asked him what might be his immediate purpose, touching his future movements. He answered to go to sea again in his old vocation. Upon this, I told him that whaling was my own design, and informed him of my intention to sail out of Nantucket as being the most promising port for an adventurous whaleman to embark from. He at once resolved to accompany me to that island, ship aboard the same vessel, get into the same watch, the same boat, the same mess with me, in short, to share my every hap, with both my hands in his, boldly dip into the potluck of both worlds. To all this I joyously assented, for besides the affection I now felt for Queequeg, he was an experienced harpooner, and as such could not fail to be of great usefulness to one like me, who was wholly ignorant of the mysteries of whaling, though well acquainted with all the sea, as known to merchant seamen. His story being ended with his pipe's last dying puff, Queequeg embraced me, pressing his forehead against mine, and blowing out the light, we rolled over from each other this way and that, and very soon were sleeping. Next morning, Monday, after disposing of the embalmed head to a barber for a block, I settled my own and comrade's bill, using, however, my comrade's money. The grinning landlord, as well as the boarders, seemed amazingly tickled at the sudden friendship which had sprung up between me and Queequeg, especially as Peter Coffin's cock-and-bull stories about him had previously so much alarmed me concerning the very person whom now I accompanied with. We borrowed a wheelbarrow, and embarking our things, including my own poor carpet-bag, and Queequeg's canvas sack and hammock, away we went down to the Moss, a little Nantucket packet schooner moored at the wharf. As we were going along, the people stared. Not at Queequeg so much, for they were used to seeing cannibals like him in their streets, but at seeing him and me upon such confidential terms. But we heeded them not, going along wheeling the barrow by turns, and Queequeg now and then stopping to adjust the sheath on his harpoon barbs. At last, passage paid and luggage safe, we stood on board the schooner. Hoisting sail, it glided down the Acushnet River. On one side, New Bedford rose in terraces of streets, their ice-covered trees all glittering in the clear, cold air. Huge hills and mountains of casks were piled upon her wharves, and side by side the world-wandering whale ships lay silent and safely moored at last, while from others came a sound of carpenters and coopers, with blended noises of fires and forges to melt the pitch, all betokening that new cruises were on the start. For one most perilous and long voyage ended, only begins a second, and a second ended, only begins a third, and so on, for ever and for aye. Such is the endlessness, yea, the intolerableness of all earthly effort. Gaining the more open water, the bracing breeze waxed fresh. The little Moss tossed the quick foam from her bows as a young colt his snortings. On and on we flew, and our offing gained, the Moss did homage to the blast, ducked and dived her bows as a slave before the Sultan. Sideways leaning, we sideways darted, every rope yarn tingling like a wire, the two tall masts buckling like Indian canes in land tornadoes. So full of this reeling scene were we, as we stood by the plunging bowsprit, that for some time we did not notice the jeering glances of the passengers, a lubber-like assembly, who marveled that two fellow beings should be so companionable, as though a white man were anything more dignified than a whitewashed negro. But there were some boobies and bumpkins there who, by their intense greenness, must have come from the very heart and center of all verdure. Queequeg caught one of these young saplings, mimicking him behind his back. I thought the bumpkin's hour of doom was come. Dropping his harpoon, the brawny savage caught him in his arms, and by an almost miraculous dexterity and strength sent him high up bodily into the air. Then, slightly tapping his stern in mid-somersault, the fellow landed with bursting lungs upon his feet, while Queequeg, turning his back upon him, lighted his tomahawk pipe and passed it to me for a puff. "Captain! Captain!" yelled the bumpkin, running towards that officer. "Captain! Captain! Here's the devil!"
"Hello, you, sir!"
cried the captain, a gaunt rib of the sea stalking up to Queequeg.
"What in thunder do you mean by that? Don't you know you might have killed that chap?"
"What him say?" said Queequeg, as he mildly turned to me. "He say," said I, "that you came near Killy, that man there," pointing to the still shivering greenhorn.
"Killy?"
cried Queequeg, twisting his tattooed face into an unearthly expression of disdain.
"Ah, him very small fishy. Queequeg no Killy so small fishy. Queequeg Killy big whale."
"Look you," roared the captain, "I'll Killy you, you cannibal, if you try any more of your tricks aboard here, so mind your eye."
but it so happened just then that it was high time for the captain to mind his own eye. The prodigious strain upon the mainsail had parted the weather sheet, and the tremendous boom was now flying from side to side, completely sweeping the entire after part of the deck. The poor fellow whom Queequeg had handled so roughly was swept overboard. All hands were in a panic, and to attempt snatching at the boom to stay it seemed madness. It flew from right to left and back again, almost in one ticking of a watch, and every instant seemed on the point of snapping into splinters. Nothing was done, and nothing seemed capable of being done. Those on deck rushed towards the bows and stood eyeing the boom as if it were the lower jaw of an exasperated whale. In the midst of this consternation, Queequeg dropped deftly to his knees, and crawling under the path of the boom, whipped hold of a rope, secured one end to the bulwarks, and then flinging the other like a lasso, caught it round the boom as it swept over his head. At the next jerk, the spar was that way trapped, and all was safe. The schooner was run into the wind, and while the hands were clearing away the sternboat, Queequeg darted from the side with a long, living arc of a leap. For 3 minutes or more, he was seen swimming like a dog, throwing his long arm straight out before him, and by turns revealing his brawny shoulders through the freezing foam. I looked at the grand and glorious fellow, but saw no one to be saved. The greenhorn had gone down. Shooting himself perpendicularly from the water, Queequeg now took an instant's glance around him, and seeming to see just how matters were, dived down and disappeared. A few minutes more, and he rose again, one arm still striking out, and with the other dragging a lifeless form. The boat soon picked them up. The poor bumpkin was restored. All hands voted Queequeg a noble trump. The captain begged his pardon. From that hour, I clove to Queequeg like a barnacle, yea, till poor Queequeg took his long last dive. Was there ever such unconsciousness? He did not seem to think that he at all deserved a medal from the humane and magnanimous societies. He only asked for water, fresh water, something to wipe the brine off. That done, he put on dry clothes, lighted his pipe, and leaning against the bulwarks and mildly eyeing those around him, seemed to be saying to himself, "It's a mutual joint-stock world in all meridians. We cannibals must help these Christians." It was quite late in the evening when the Little Moss came snugly to anchor in Nantucket, and Queequeg and I went ashore, so we could attend to no business that day, at least none but a supper and a bed. The landlord of the Spouter Inn had recommended us to his cousin, Hosea Hussey, of the Trypots, whom he asserted to be the proprietor of one of the best-kept hotels in all Nantucket. In short, he plainly hinted that we could not possibly do better than to try potluck at the Trypots. And so it turned out. Mr. Hosea Hussey was from home, but had left Mrs. Hussey entirely competent to attend to all his affairs. Upon making known our desires for a supper and a bed, Mrs. Hussey ushered us into a little room and seated us at a table. Supper concluded, we received a lamp and directions from Mrs. Hussey concerning the nearest way to bed. Next morning early, leaving Queequeg, I sallied out among the shipping. After much prolonged sauntering and many random inquiries, I learned that there were 3 ships up for 3 years' voyages: the Devil Dam, the Titbit, and the Pequod. I peered and pried about the Devil Dam, from her hopping over to the Titbit, and finally going on board the Pequod, looking around her for a moment, and then decided that this was the very ship for us. You may have seen many a quaint craft in your day, for aught I know, square-toed luggers, mountainous Japanese junks, butter-box galliots, and whatnot, but take my word for it, you never saw such a rare old craft as this same rare old Pequod. She was a ship of the old school, rather small, if anything, with an old-fashioned, claw-footed look about her. Long-seasoned and weather-stained in the typhoons and calms of all 4 oceans, Her old hull's complexion was darkened like a French grenadier's. Her venerable bows looked bearded. Her masts stood stiffly up like the spines of the three old kings of Cologne. Her ancient decks were worn and wrinkled, like the pilgrim-worshipped flagstone in Canterbury Cathedral, where Becket bled. Now, when I looked about the quarterdeck for someone having authority, in order to propose myself as a candidate for the voyage, at first I saw nobody. But I could not well overlook a strange sort of tent, or rather wigwam, pitched a little behind the mainmast. It seemed only a temporary erection used in port. It was of a conical shape, some 10 feet high, consisting of the long, large slabs of limber black bone taken from the middle and highest parts of the jaws of the right whale. Planted with their broad ends on the deck, a circle of these slabs, laced together, mutually sloped towards each other, and at their apex, united in a tufted point, where the loose, hairy fibers waved to and fro like the topknot on some old Pottawatomie Sachem's head. A triangular opening faced towards the bows of the ship, so that the insider commanded a complete view forward. And half concealed in this queer tenement, I at length found one who, by his aspect, seemed to have authority, and who, it being noon and the ship's work suspended, was now enjoying respite from the burden of command. He was seated on an old-fashioned oaken chair, wriggling all over with curious carving. There was nothing so very particular, perhaps, about the appearance of the elderly man I saw. He was brown and brawny, like most old seamen, and heavily rolled up in blue pilot cloth, cut in the Quaker style. Only there was a fine and almost microscopic network of minutest wrinkles interlaced round his eyes, which must have arisen from his continual sailings in many hard gales. "Is this the captain of the Pequod?" said I, advancing to the door of the tent.
"Supposing it be the captain of the Pequod, what dost thou want of him?" he demanded.
I was thinking of shipping.
"Thou wast thou? I see thou art no Nantucketer. Ever been in a stove boat?"
"No, sir, I never have."
"Dost know nothing at all about whaling, I dare say, eh?"
"Nothing, sir. But I have no doubt I shall soon learn. I've been several voyages in the merchant service, and I think that—"
"Merchant service be damned! Talk not that lingo to me, merchant service, indeed. I suppose now ye feel considerable proud of having served in those merchant ships. But flukes, man, what makes thee want to go a-whaling, eh? It looks a little suspicious, don't it, eh? Hast not been a pirate, hast thou? Didst not rob thy last captain, didst thou? Dost not think of murdering the officers when thou gettest to sea?"
I protested my innocence of these things. I saw that under the mask of these half-humorous innuendos, this old seaman, as an insulated Quakerish Nantucketer, was full of his insular prejudices, and rather distrustful of all aliens unless they hailed from Cape Cod or the Vineyard.
"But what takes thee a-whaling? I want to know that before I think of shipping ye."
"Well, sir, I want to see what whaling is. I want to see the world."
"Want to see what whaling is, eh? Have ye clapped eyes on Captain Ahab?"
"Who is Captain Ahab, sir?"
Aye, I thought so. Captain Ahab is the captain of this ship."
"I am mistaken, then. I thought I was speaking to the captain himself."
"Thou art speaking to Captain Peleg. That's who ye are speaking to, young man, part owner and agent. It belongs to me to see the Pequod fitted out for the voyage and supplied with all her needs, including crew. But as I was going to say, if thou wantest to know what whaling is, as thou tellest ye do, I can put ye in a way of finding out before ye bind yourself to it, past backing out. Clap eye on Captain Ahab, young man, and thou wilt find that he has only one leg."
"What do you mean, sir? Was the other one lost by a whale?"
"Lost by a whale? Young man, come nearer to me. It was devoured crunched by the monstrousest parmacetti that ever chipped about.
I was a little alarmed by his energy, perhaps also a little touched at the hearty grief in his concluding exclamation, but said as calmly as I could, "What you say is no doubt true enough, sir, but how could I know there was any peculiar ferocity in that particular whale, though indeed I might have inferred as much from the simple fact of the accident?"
"I have given thee a hint about what whaling is. Do ye yet feel inclined for it?"
"I do, sir."
"Very good. Now, art thou the man to pitch a harpoon down a live whale's throat and then jump after it? Answer quick."
"I am, sir, if it should be positively indispensable to do so, not to be got rid of, that is, which I don't take to be the fact."
"Good again. Now then, thou not only wantest to go a-whaling, but find out by experience what whaling is, but ye also want to go in order to see the world. Was not that what he said?" "I thought so." "Well then, just step forward there and take a peep over the weather bow, and then back to me and tell me what ye see there."
For a moment I stood a little puzzled by this curious request, not knowing exactly how to take it, whether humorously or in earnest. But concentrating all his crow's feet into one scowl, Captain Peleg started me on the errand. Going forward and glancing over the weather bow, I perceived that the ship, swinging to her anchor with the flood tide, was now obliquely pointing towards the open ocean. The prospect was unlimited, but exceedingly monotonous and forbidding, not the slightest variety that I could see.
"Well, what's the report?"
said Peleg when I came back.
"What did ye see?"
"Not much," I replied. "Nothing but water. Considerable horizon, though, and there's a squall coming up, I think."
"Well, what dost thou think, then, of seeing the world? Do ye wish to go round Cape Horn to see any more of it, eh? Can't ye see the world where ye stand?"
I was a little staggered, but go a-whaling I must, and I would, and the Pequod was as good a ship as any. I thought the best, and all this I now repeated to Peleg. Seeing me so determined, he expressed his willingness to ship me.
"And thou mayest as well sign the papers right off," he added. "Come along with ye."
And so saying, he led the way below deck into the cabin. After signing the papers, I said, "Captain Peleg, I have a friend with me who wants to ship too. Shall I bring him down tomorrow?"
"To be sure," said Peleg. "Fetch him along, and we'll look at him."
And so off I went, nothing doubting but that I had done a good morning's work. But I had not proceeded far when I began to bethink me that the captain with whom I was to sail yet remained unseen by me. Though indeed a whale ship will be completely fitted out and receive all her crew on board ere the captain makes himself visible by arriving to take command. For sometimes these voyages are so prolonged, and the shore intervals at home so exceedingly brief, that if the captain have a family or any absorbing concernment of that sort, he does not trouble himself much about his ship in port, but leaves her to the owners till all is ready for sea. However, it is always as well to have a look at him before irrevocably committing yourself into his hands. Turning back, I accosted Captain Peleg, inquiring where Captain Ahab was to be found.
"And what dost thou want of Captain Ahab?" "It's all right enough. Thou art shipped."
"Yes, but I should like to see him."
"But I don't think thou wilt be able to at present. I don't know exactly what's the matter with him, but he keeps close inside the house. A sort of sick, and yet he don't look so. In fact, he ain't sick. But no, he isn't well either. Anyhow, young man, he won't always see me, so I don't suppose he will see thee. He's a queer man, Captain Ahab, so some think, but a good one. Oh, thou'lt like him well enough, no fear, no fear."
He paused thoughtfully for a moment and then continued,
"Mark ye, be forewarned. Ahab's above the common. Ahab's been in colleges, as well as among the cannibals, been used to deeper wonders than the waves, fixed his fiery lance in mightier, stranger foes than whales. I know that he was never very jolly, and I know that on the passage home he was a little out of his mind for a spell, but it was the sharp shooting pains in his bleeding stump that brought that about, as anyone might see. I know, too, that ever since he lost his leg last voyage by that accursed whale, he's been a kind of moody, desperate, moody, and savage sometimes. But that will all pass off. And once for all, let me tell thee and assure thee, young man, it is better to sail with a moody, good captain than a laughing bad one.
As I walked away, I was full of thoughtfulness. What had been incidentally revealed to me of Captain Ahab filled me with a certain wild vagueness of painfulness concerning him. And somehow, at the time, I felt a sympathy and a sorrow for him, but for I don't know what, unless it was the cruel loss of his leg. And yet I also felt a strange awe of him, but it did not disincline me towards him.
As we were walking down the end of the wharf the following morning towards the ship, Queequeg carrying his harpoon, Captain Peleg in his gruff voice loudly hailed us from his wigwam.
"Come aboard! Come aboard! Tell your friend to step along. What's his name?"
"Queequeg," said I.
"By the great anchor, what a harpoon he's got there! Looks like good stuff, that, and he handles it about right. I say, Quahog, or whatever your name is, did you ever stand in the head of a whaleboat? Did you ever strike a fish?"
Without saying a word, Queequeg, in his wild sort of way, jumped upon the bulwarks, from thence into the bows of one of the whaleboats hanging to the side, and then bracing his left knee and poising his harpoon, cried out in some such way as this:
"Cap'n, you see him small drop tar on water there? You see him? Well, suppose him one whale eye. Well, then!"
And taking sharp aim at it, he darted the iron clean across the ship's decks and struck the glistening tar spot out of sight.
"Now," he said, quietly hauling in the line, "suppose him whale eye. Why, that whale dead." "By heaven," Captain Peleg shouted, "we must have Hedgehog there, Quahog, in one of our boats."
So down we went into the cabin, and to my great joy, Queequeg was soon enrolled among the same ship's company to which I myself belonged. A day or two passed, and there was great activity aboard the Pequod. Not only were the old sails being mended, but new sails were coming on board, and bolts of canvas and coils of rigging. In short, everything betokened that the ship's preparations were hurrying to a close. Captain Peleg seldom or never went ashore, but sat in his wigwam keeping a sharp lookout upon the hands. On the day following Queequeg's signing the articles, word was given at all the inns where the ship's company were stopping that their chests must be on board before night, for there was no telling how soon the vessel might be sailing. So Queequeg and I got down our traps, resolving, however, to sleep ashore till the last. But it seems they always give very long notice in these cases, and the ship did not sail for several days. Everyone knows what a multitude of things are indispensable to the business of housekeeping. Just so with whaling, which necessitates a 3 years' housekeeping upon the wide ocean, far from all grocers, costermongers, doctors, bakers, and bankers. And though this holds true of merchant vessels, yet not by any means to the same extent as with whalemen. For besides the great length of the whaling voyage, the numerous articles peculiar to the prosecution of the fishery, and the impossibility of replacing them at the remote harbors usually frequented, it must be remembered that, of all ships, whaling vessels are the most exposed to accidents of all kinds, and especially to the destruction and loss of the very things upon which the success of the voyage most depends. Hence the spare boats, spare spars, and spare lines and harpoons, and spare everything's almost but a spare captain and duplicate ship.
At the period of our arrival at the island, the heaviest stowage of the Pequod had been almost completed, comprising her beef, bread, water, fuel, and iron hoops and staves. But for some time there was a continual fetching and carrying on board of diverse odds and ends of things, both large and small. At last, however, it was given out that some time next day the ship would certainly sail. So next morning, Queequeg and I took a very early start. It was nearly 6 o'clock, but only gray, imperfect, misty dawn when we drew nigh the wharf. Stepping on board the Pequod, we found everything in profound quiet, not a soul moving. The cabin entrance was locked within. The hatches were all on and lumbered with coils of rigging. Going forward to the forecastle, we found the slide of the scuttle open. Seeing a light, we went down and found only an old rigger there, wrapped in a tattered pea jacket. He was thrown at whole length upon two chests, his face downwards, and enclosed in his folded arms. The profoundest slumber slept upon him. I jocularly hinted to Queequeg that perhaps we had best sit up with the body, telling him to establish himself accordingly. He put his hand upon the sleeper's rear, as though feeling as if it was soft enough, and then, without more ado, sat quietly down there. "Gracious, Queequeg, don't sit there," said I.
"Oh, very good seat," said Queequeg. "My country way. Won't hurt him face."
"Face," said I. "Call that his face? Very benevolent countenance, then. But how hard he breathes. He's heaving himself. Get off, Queequeg. You are heavy. It's grinding the face of the poor. Look, he'll twitch you off soon. I wonder he don't wake." Queequeg removed himself to just beyond the head of the sleeper and lighted his tomahawk pipe. I sat at the feet. We kept the pipe passing over the sleeper from one to the other. Meanwhile, upon questioning him in his broken fashion, Queequeg gave me to understand that, in his land, owing to the absence of settees and sofas of all sorts, the kings, chiefs, and great people generally were in the custom of fattening some of the lower orders for ottomans, and to furnish a house comfortably in that respect, you had only to buy up 8 or 10 lazy fellows and lay them round in the piers and alcoves. While narrating these things, every time Queequeg received the tomahawk from me, he flourished the hatchet side of it over the sleeper's head. "What's that for?" I asked.
"Very easy, Killy. Oh, very easy."
He was going on with some wild reminiscences about his tomahawk pipe, which, it seemed, had in its two uses both brained his foes and soothed his soul, when we were directly attracted to the sleeping rigger. The strong vapor now completely filling the contracted hole, it began to tell upon him. He breathed with a sort of muffledness, then seemed troubled in the nose, then revolved over once or twice, then sat up and rubbed his eyes.
"Halloa," he breathed at last. "Who be ye smokers?"
"Shipped men," I answered. "When does she sail?"
"She sails today. The captain came aboard last night."
"Captain Ahab?"
"Who but him, indeed?"
I was going to ask him some further questions concerning Ahab when we heard a noise on deck.
"Halloa, Starbuck's sister," said the rigger. "He's a lively chief mate, that. A good man and a pious. But all alive now, I must turn to."
And so saying, he went on deck, and we followed. It was now a clear sunrise. Soon the crew came on board in twos and threes, the riggers bestirred themselves, the mates were actively engaged, and several of the shore people were busy in bringing various last things on board. Meanwhile, Captain Ahab remained invisibly enshrined within his cabin. At length, towards noon, upon the final dismissal of the ship's riggers, and after the Pequod had been hauled out from the wharf, Captain Peleg issued from the cabin, and turning to the chief mate said,
"Now, Mr. Starbuck, are you sure everything is right? Captain Ahab is all ready. Just spoke to him. Nothing more to be got from shore, eh? Muster him aft here."
As for Captain Ahab, no sign of him was yet to be seen. But then his presence was by no means necessary in getting the ship under way and steering her well out to sea. Indeed, as that was not at all his proper business, but the pilot's, and he was not yet completely recovered, so they said. Therefore, Captain Ahab stayed below. And all this seemed natural enough, especially as in the merchant service many captains never show themselves on deck for a considerable time after heaving up anchor. But there was not much chance to think over the matter, for Captain Peleg was now all alive.
"Aft here, ye sons of bachelors!" he cried, as the sailors lingered at the mainmast. "Mr. Starbuck, drive 'em aft! Strike the tent there!" was the next order.
This whalebone marquee was never pitched except in port, and on board the Pequod for 30 years, the order to strike the tent was well known to be the next thing to heaving up the anchor.
"Man the capstan! Blood and thunder, jump!"
was the next command, and the crew sprang for the handspikes. Now, in getting under way, the station generally occupied by the pilot is the forward part of the ship, and here be it known that Peleg, in addition to his other offices, was one of the licensed pilots of the port. At last the anchor was up, the sails were set, and off we glided. The chief mate of the Pequod was Starbuck, a native of Nantucket and a Quaker by descent. He was a long, earnest man, and though born on an icy coast, seemed well adapted to endure hot latitudes, his flesh being hard as twice-baked biscuit. He must have been born in some time of general drought and famine, or upon one of those fast days for which his state is famous. Only some 30 arid summers had he seen. These summers had dried up all his physical superfluousness. He was by no means ill-looking, quite the contrary. His pure, tight skin was an excellent fit, and closely wrapped up in it and embalmed with inner health and strength, like a revivified Egyptian, this Starbuck seemed prepared to endure for long ages to come, and to endure always as now. For be it polar snow or torrid sun, like a patent chronometer, his interior vitality was warranted to do well in all climates. Looking into his eyes, you seemed to see there the yet lingering images of those thousandfold perils he had calmly confronted through life. Yet for all his hearty sobriety and fortitude, there were certain qualities in him which at times affected, and in some cases seemed well nigh to overbalance, all the rest. Uncommonly conscientious for a seaman, and endued with a deep, natural reverence, the wild, watery loneliness of his life did therefore strongly incline him to superstition. But to that sort of superstition which in some organizations seems rather to spring somehow from intelligence rather than from ignorance. Outward portents and inward presentiments were his. And if at times these things bent the welded iron of his soul, much more did his faraway domestic memories of his young Cape wife and child tend to bend him still more from the original ruggedness of his nature. "I will have no man in my boat," said Starbuck, "who is not afraid of a whale." By this he seemed to mean not only that the most reliable and useful courage was that which arises from the fair estimation of the encountered peril, but that an utterly fearless man is a far more dangerous comrade than a coward. "Aye, aye," said Stubb, the second mate. "Starbuck there is as careful a man as you'll find anywhere in this fishery." Starbuck was no crusader after perils. In him, courage was not a sentiment, but a thing simply useful to him, and always at hand upon all mortally practical occasions. Wherefore he had no fancy for lowering for whales after sundown, nor for persisting in fighting a fish that too much persisted in fighting him. "For," thought Starbuck, "I am here in this critical ocean to kill whales for my living, and not to be killed by them for theirs." And that hundreds of men had been so killed, Starbuck well knew. What doom was his own father's? Where, in the bottomless deeps, could he find the torn limbs of his brother? With memories like these in him, and moreover given to a certain superstitiousness, as has been said, the courage of this Starbuck, which could nevertheless still flourish, must indeed have been extreme. But it was not in reasonable nature that a man so organized, and with such terrible experiences and remembrances as he had, should fail in latently engendering an element in him which, under suitable circumstances, would break out from its confinement and burn all his courage up. And brave as he might be, it was that sort of bravery which, while generally abiding firm in the conflict with seas or winds or whales or any of the ordinary irrational horrors of the world, yet cannot withstand those more terrific, because more spiritual terrors, which sometimes menace you from the concentrating brow of an enraged and mighty man. Stubb was the second mate. He was a native of Cape Cod, a happy-go-lucky, neither craven nor valiant, taking perils as they came with an indifferent air, and while engaged in the most imminent crisis of the chase, toiling away, calm and collected as a journeyman joiner engaged for the year. Good-humored, easy, and careless, he presided over his whaleboat as if the most deadly encounter were but a dinner, and his crew all invited guests. He was as particular about the comfortable arrangement of his part of the boat as an old stage driver is about the snugness of his box. When close to the whale, in the very deathlock of the fight, he handled his unpitying lance coolly and offhandedly, as a whistling tinker his hammer. He would hum over his old rigadig tunes, while flank and flank with the most exasperated monster. What perhaps, with other things, made Stubb such an easy-going, unfearing man, so cheerily trudging off with the burden of life in a world full of grave peddlers, all bowed to the ground with their packs, what helped to bring about that almost impious good humor of his? That thing must have been his pipe. For like his nose, his short, black little pipe was one of the regular features of his face. You would almost as soon have expected him to turn out of his bunk without his nose as without his pipe. He kept a whole row of pipes there, ready loaded, stuck in a rack, within easy reach of his hand, and whenever he turned in, he smoked them all out in succession, lighting one from the other to the end of the chapter, then loading them again to be in readiness anew. For when Stubb dressed, instead of first putting his legs into his trousers, he put his pipe into his mouth. The third mate was Flask, a native of Tisbury in Martha's Vineyard, a short, stout, ruddy young fellow, very pugnacious concerning whales, who somehow seemed to think that the great leviathans had personally and hereditarily affronted him, and therefore it was a sort of point of honor with him to destroy them whenever encountered. So utterly lost was he to all sense of reverence for the many marvels of their majestic bulk and mystic ways, and so dead to anything like an apprehension of any possible danger from encountering them, that in his poor opinion, the wondrous whale was but a species of magnified mouse, or at least water rat, requiring only a little circumvention and some small application of time and trouble in order to kill and boil. This ignorant, unconscious fearlessness of his made him a little waggish in the matter of whales. He followed these fish for the fun of it, and a 3 years' voyage round Cape Horn was only a jolly joke that lasted that length of time. They called him King Post on board of the Pequod, because in form he could well be likened to the short, square timber known by that name in Arctic whalers, and which by the means of many radiating side timbers inserted into it serves to brace the ship against the icy concussions of those battering seas. Now these three mates, Starbuck, Stubb, and Flask, were momentous men. They it was who, by universal prescription, commanded three of the Pequod's boats as headsmen. In that grand order of battle in which Captain Ahab would presently marshal his forces to descend on the whales, these three headsmen were as captains of companies. Or being armed with their long, keen whaling spears, they were as a picked trio of lancers, even as the harpooneers were flingers of javelins. Now, in this famous fishery, each mate or headsman, like a Gothic knight of old, is always accompanied by his boat-steerer or harpooneer. In certain conjunctures, the harpooner provides him with a fresh lance when the former one has been badly twisted or elbowed in the assault, and moreover, as there generally subsists between the two a close intimacy and friendliness, it is therefore but meet that I now mention who the Pequod's harpooners were, and to what headsman each of them belonged. First of all was Queequeg, whom Starbuck, the chief mate, had selected for his squire. But Queequeg is already known to you. Next was Tashtego, an unmixed Indian from Gay Head, the most westerly promontory of Martha's Vineyard, where there still exists the last remnant of a village of red men, which has long supplied the neighboring island of Nantucket with many of her most daring harpooners. In the fishery, they usually go by the generic name of Gayheaders. Tashtego's long, lean, sable hair, his high cheekbones and black, rounding eyes, for an Indian, oriental in their largeness, but Antarctic in their glittering expression, all this sufficiently proclaimed him an inheritor of the unvitiated blood of those proud warrior hunters who, in quest of the great New England moose, had scoured, bow in hand, the aboriginal forests of the Maine. But no longer snuffing in the trail of the wild beasts of the woodland, Tashtego now hunted in the wake of the great whales of the sea, the unerring harpoon of sun fitly replacing the infallible arrow of the sires. To look at the tawny brawn of his lithe, snaky limbs, you would almost have credited the superstitions of some of the earlier Puritans, and half believed this wild Indian to be a son of the prince of the powers of the air. Tashtego was Stubb the second mate's squire.